Hey, here we are again at Old School Guns, the podcast that has the information, the opinion, and the answers that you want to know. First couple of things we're going to look at is some things in the news. And I don't know if you saw it, but you know, we talked in the last podcast about the coach of the Golden State Warriors and how he's anti-gun because his father was killed by jihadists in Lebanon 30-some years ago, which is a tragedy, which is a terrible tragedy. But it really shouldn't be influencing gun ownership, a constitutional right in the United States today. But, you know, if that's how he wants to think about it, that's fine. But the thing that drew my attention this week was the infamous push during one of the playoff games. One of the minority owners, you know, a small share owner of the Golden State Warriors, was sitting courtside. One of the other players came careening into the seats, and this guy kind of gave him a little bit of a shove. It wasn't a assaultive shove or anything really bad, but you would have thought that it was an absolute just physical confrontation assault. And in fact, it was not. And it should have been just something that was just shrugged off by everybody. Maybe the guy should have apologized, which he eventually did anyway. But instead, it's banned for a year and a $500,000 fine and ejected from the game and all this. And I'm for, you know, people shouldn't be roughing up players or anything like that. But there's always a common sense line that just never seems to emerge, and they treat every offense like it's this massive breach. And frankly, that player for the Raptors, he's a wussy. He is an entitled little jerk who, you know, just if you can't put up with something like that and shrug it off, you are not much of a man and not much of a person. I can tell you from my own perspective and other people who are airborne, old term meaning a paratrooper, there are people who will help you to get out of the aircraft. If you're going and you freeze or you hesitate or for whatever reason, they will help you exit the aircraft. They will put their hands on you. They will push you. You will get out. And you know, that's actually for your own good, but it's also, you know, we live in a world where sometimes people are going to put their hands on you, and you have to shrug it off. Nobody goes back to the jump master and says, hey, you shoved me out of the airplane, you know, and now I'm all offended. No, it's just the way of life. Sometimes you get jostled. Sometimes you get hands put on you. Go through the airport. I don't know how this guy from the NBA Raptors gets through the airport. Probably, though, they fly on charters, and they probably he probably gets some entitled treatment. The problem with our society is we've entitled and treated with outrageous privilege some of these sports knuckleheads. So he's probably been treated that way since he was a grade school phenom, and now it goes into the world of basketball. But, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, he's going to be a nobody out on the street, just a memory, and he's going to have to then cope with real life. And that's going to be the most interesting part of this is how do these guys wind up coping with real life? And as we see from case after case after case, they usually don't cope very well. They usually are they usually come to an end that people who are responsible and have worked all their lives really don't want to come to. Well, it seems there are two suppressor controversies in the news, one well-known, the other not so well-known. The well-known one is, did the Virginia Beach shooter use a suppressor, and should those now be banned, either by presidential fiat or by legislation? And I don't think this is going to really go very far. Most people have kind of caught on that a suppressor really isn't what people think as far as its performance in the movies vis-a-vis real life. In real life, they reduce some noise, they're large, they're awkward, they actually don't help accuracy, they heat up, there's a lot of debits to a suppressor. The overwhelming benefit is it can reduce the amount of decibels that a gunshot or gun report has. But if you're around other guns that are not suppressed, you've got to wear hearing protection and all that anyway, so it's really only a benefit if you're kind of alone. And perhaps it has some hunting application, you know, that would be kind of nice, or predator, varmint, dangerous animal control, where you don't want to alarm large groups of people, you know, in and around residential type areas. I think that there's some law enforcement uses that definitely could benefit from it. But anyway, it's really become a non-issue. Most shooters are without it, and the ones that really want it can go get it through the NFA. And that's another item should be removed from the NFA. It doesn't have an impact on crime. Therefore, people should be allowed to own it. People should be allowed to own it with as little regulatory hassle as possible. The second one is the state of Kansas. There's a lawsuit basically in federal court saying, hey, Kansas has a law saying that if you build, you can build weapons and suppressors in Kansas, and as long as you keep them there, they are exempt from federal regulations. Well, a person who was a disabled veteran who had significantly hearing loss purchased one of these. The purchase was tracked down through some sort of federal action, and he was convicted in federal court of possessing. The seller was convicted for selling it, on and on. But under Kansas law, it is legal, so that will go to court. This could be a far-reaching case if it's decided in the favor that if you have it and your state allows it, that really the feds don't have any jurisdiction over it, vis-a-vis the Interstate Commerce Clause or whatever overarching law that they want to use to try to regulate everything. So that'll be interesting to see. Not much reported on it in the news, but theoretically that could mean that Class 3 items could be manufactured in Kansas or states that have similar laws, and you can possess them there as long as you don't cross state lines. You would be good to go. That would be huge news. Huge, huge news. What that would really cause is probably some sort of compromise where the NFA would be opened again for manufacture of certain Class 3 items, meaning select fire or fully automatic weapons, so as it was pre-1986. So that's what could come out of it. That's what could come out of it. It would be nice, and it would be nice if that was kind of done with an executive order, and I'd like to see that happen, definitely. But as of right now, those things are NFA controlled, and the federal law seem to be supreme, but there is a challenge to that. Okay, we still have the same goings on at the NRA. You know, a lot of controversy has pretty much died down, and now it's just the diehards, the people who don't like the NRA, kind of quipping and creating kind of fake social media responses and all that. But, you know, essentially it looks like that there was a lot of nothing there. There was no there. The expenses that they were accusing LaPierre of appear to be over a period of at least 15 years, maybe even longer. And while you can argue whether or not the type of money involved is excessive or not, I mean, I think you have to say that over 15 years, that basically brings it down to a much more palatable level for most of the members. But, you know, the truth is, if we don't stick together, we won't have the rights. I mean, the Democrats seem to be flirting with the idea of gun control, seeing if it's going to be a winning issue. I personally think it's going to be a losing issue, because the predominant candidates that are pushing that, like Kamala Harris, just aren't gaining any traction. That's her whole thing. Same thing with Solwell, you know, Mr. Sewagewell, who wanted to threaten everybody. Those guys, they can't get it. They are, nobody is following that. Biden sort of says it. He's got the lead right now, but basically that's all based on name recognition. And, you know, historically, the person who's the front runner at this point in the race there's a high probability that they're not going to be the nominees. So it'll be interesting to see. The Democratic Party has taken a hard turn to the left, and in the past that has been that's been political suicide. It did work for them in 1932, but in 1972 it was a complete unmitigated disaster, and it may turn out that way again, although the country is far more polarized and there's far more liberal-minded people now. So, you know, hardcore liberalism, it's going to be interesting to see whether it falls flat or it gains any kind of traction. I think it'll gain some traction, but I think they will eventually lose, because I just don't think as a strategy it's really going to pay off. Hey, we're going to get into some Q&A here, and we got some very interesting questions this cast, and let's go into the first one. And the first one is, can you compare the breech loader conversions of long arms? And I think what this is talking about are the long arms that were converted from muzzle loading to breech loading. And there were a couple different systems that did that, and there were other couple other guns that were on the periphery of that. So the ones we're talking about is the Allen conversion, which became the trapdoor system, and the Snyder conversion the British used, which basically they used for probably 15-20 years. These things emerged both in the middle 1860s, the American ones essentially right after the Civil War. The British ones, I think that first one was 1864. And what these did was they converted muzzle-loading rifles into breech loaders. And by doing that, they would cut away a piece of the breech, put in a mechanism with a firing pin, modify the hammer, and make them, and they'd have to tweak the chamber, and they'd make them suitable for brass cartridges, self-contained brass cartridges. And they all work pretty well. They really were never designed to be one-upsmanship or compared to each other. What they were designed to do was convert existing arms, which were obsolete, into something that was much more useful. And that's what they did. The Allen conversion is probably the better conversion, and it survived into the 1890s. And it started at 58 caliber to match the old rifle musket caliber. Then they went down to 50 caliber. And then just a few years later, we got the 45-70. And they were, of course, manufacturing these rifles new from essentially the late 1860s and 1870s into the 1890s. So they were very long-lived, good system. Flips out the empty, it's fast to load, very, very good, and a relatively strong system compared that, you know, it was designed on a conversion. Now, why did the U.S. military go with that? The biggest reason is it saved money, because they already owned the rights to that. They didn't have to buy it from a private company. The Remington Rolling Block was a very good rifle, designed ground up to be a cartridge rifle. However, they would have had to buy at least the rights from Remington, if not the rifles. So that just wasn't going to happen in the austere period during the Indian Wars, up until the Spanish-American War. That just wasn't going to happen. So they used a serviceable system that was tried and true, and it was found to be very successful. Same thing with the British. The Snyder is they're both slow systems. The trapdoor and the Snyder are both slow systems. The Snyder, you actually have to turn the rifle to kind of get the empty out. You push back on the breech. Breech has got a little place where you can hold it, and you pull back on the breech block, and it pulls the empty back out. And then you have to trip the rifle over to get that thing to fall out. But compared to a muzzleloader, it's a lot faster, and you can fire basically a dozen cartridges where you only might get three or four or five shots out of a muzzle loader, and you could probably do even better than that. So those were two excellent ones. There were a couple others that kind of fall into this category, and that is the 50-70 conversions of Civil War era Sharps carbines those kind of took a paper cartridge, you know, it didn't really hold up to the weather very well, kind of a paper cartridge filled with powder with a bullet on the end of it, and you put that in a chamber, you close a breech block, it would nip the back of the cartridge off, you put a percussion cap on and fire. The self-contained cartridge, much more weather resistant and much faster. You didn't have to fool with the percussion caps, which are tiny and comparatively tiny, and you have to seat them onto the cone or nipple exactly right. So, you know, it was a big leap forward. So those were really excellent. Then you get into actually the purpose-built single-shot rifles, and that's like the Martini Henry, the Remington Rolling Block, and there are others. European countries all had a couple different systems that were out there, and those work exceptionally well even today. They're very, very quick firing for single shots, and they were quite effective, much better, a huge leap forward from the muzzle loading rifles. So they were never designed to be compared against each other. They were really, even the purpose-built ones, they were really designed to how much faster than a muzzle loader can they be, and they all are basically successful, and they were, you know, in use in secondary roles and in other things up through the First World War. The guards at civilian ordnance plants in the United States, where there had been some sabotage, many of them were armed with, you know, kind of these surplus, not suitable for combat trapdoor rifles. Same thing, the British broke out Martini Henry rifles, and some of their auxiliaries even had Snider rifles. Not used on the Western Front, but used for policing back in the colonies or and in their other, you know, kind of far-flung possessions. Those rifles were there. The French used 8mm Lebel Remington rolling blocks because that was the only rifle. They were short of weapons. That was the only rifle they could get in their service caliber that they could import numbers of. The Germans in Southeast Africa used Model 1871 84 Mauser rifles that took an 11mm, approximately 45 caliber black powder cartridge, and that was in frontline service. The better rifles that they had during that campaign were the ones that they had captured from the Allies, and in a couple of instances when they were running low or ran out of ammo for those captures, they had to go back to the Mausers. So those rifles did have a good 40, 50-year run in service, and after that, they essentially, after the First World War, with kind of a glut of much more modern rifles, they essentially disappeared. But you know, they were functional, and they did what they were supposed to do, which is deliver, you know, reasonably fast, accurate rounds, better than their muzzle-loading predecessors. So that's what I would say, is that they all were essentially successful because they all essentially had the same goal, which is be faster than a muzzle loader. Okay, the next question is, do you like CNR Arsenal? Well, they're a YouTube channel. I like them. I think they put on some interesting content. Some of the guns they have are very, very interesting. Is it the format I would choose? Is it something that I find very inspiring or entertaining? And I would say that it's on the low end. They kind of come across as sort of these clunky gun shop commando types. The guy is sort of a historian, the gal is just out there shooting guns, and neither of them seem to have a military or law enforcement background. Not that that is essential, because some of those people are just off hawking books or training courses, but there's no real operational base there. They've never seemed to have had any kind of employment where they've ever been issued, carried, or qualified with weapons. So it's more just like fun Sunday afternoon shooting as opposed to, yeah, I used to have to carry things seriously, and here's what I liked, and here's what I didn't, and here's how this stacks up. It seems to be just more of a academic exercise. And, you know, it just comes across clunky. But some of their stuff is interesting. So, yes, I do like them, but are they my favorite? No. I still prefer, although I disagree with them frequently, I still prefer In-Range TV and Forgotten Weapons. I think that's some very, very good quality content that is very interesting. Suffers from some of the same weaknesses, but usually they focus their subject matter such that it's not that apparent. Okay, let's go with this. Pistol brace versus bump stock. Well, as I've said before, I think bump stocks are for morons. I mean, I think you have to be a fool to think that a bump stock is giving you any kind of real life capability other than noise making and kind of a hold my beer and watch this moment. The thing about a bump stock is it makes a gun less safe because there's less control, and it's behaving in a way for which it really wasn't designed. It's modifying how a gun is fired away from what its design was. So I don't like it. Don't like them for those reasons. The other thing is, clearly, they're clearly unsafe because you would never give one to a 10-year-old to use. I mean, you just wouldn't do that. And if you do, you're an even bigger fool than I would even think for owning a bump stock. But it's something that a child or a young shooter cannot control. Inexperienced shooter cannot control it. You're going to have bullets going over everywhere. Fully automatic weapons can be fired safely and efficiently, but even then you have to be careful. Remember a few years ago, there was a little girl who was like six or seven years old, and they had her with a fully automatic Uzi with the range officer at one of these gun rental places, and she was firing the gun. She dropped it, and one of the bullets hit the range officer in the head and killed him. These are not toys, and bump stocks kind of give people the impression they're kind of a toy for your gun. It's not a serious tool for serious use. So it really is something that has no use. Now, a pistol brace makes a gun more controllable and thus safer, especially when you're talking on something like an AR pistol, which I'm not a real fan of, a full caliber like 5.56 AR pistol. I don't think that they're particularly a good choice for anything other than maximum concealment and using a large cartridge at a fairly close target. I don't think they're really much good for anything else. But with pistol brace on, they can be a lot more controllable. They can be a lot more useful, and it becomes a little miniature carbine that could have some tactical use, VIP protection, a few other things. If it were me, I would think that 9mm would probably be the ideal caliber for one of those. Although there are some FUD calibers coming out, you know, the 350 Legend, which is kind of a 35 caliber. That might be interesting. I think though my gut feeling is that would generate a little too much recoil. 300 Blackout might be very interesting in one of those pistols. But I think 9mm, just for ammo availability, ammo price, and probably magazine availability and things like that, it would probably be the best choice. But you could get a very compact package with the pistol brace and very rapid firing with 9mm, and have a pretty good little carbine. So they make a pistol brace makes a firearm more controllable, which is a good thing. A bump stock makes them less controllable and less safe, which is a very, very bad thing. Very bad thing. We have another question here, which is interesting, is how young should a child be taught to shoot? And there's of course two components to that. What is what is legally appropriate and what is appropriate for a child given their level of development. Some children, even into adulthood, will never be suitable or should be trusted shooting anything. And some children who are mature for their age can probably handle some sort of at least limited exposure to firearms at a comparatively early age. I would say that I would have to err on the side of caution and say the youngest I would consider doing it, and it would start with safety teaching and very, very simple, like single-shot firearms. I would do that at about 10 years old. I think that's appropriate. They can learn how to handle simple, basic firearms. And I did this with my stepson. He had a single-shot 22 and a single-shot 410 that was actually mine. And those were the guns he kind of learned on. And you can learn the basics and principles with a very simple mechanism. And at 10 years old, you can really start that. Starting kids at 6 and 7, and when you see YouTube pictures of a 4 and 5-year-old holding little cricket guns, I just don't see that as being very smart. I would think that at that age, the very young age, the difference between a toy and a real, you know, they play with toys all the time, even if it's not toy guns, but they play with other toys. So can the child really differentiate between a toy and a serious tool? And I'd have to say that my thoughts are that essentially you can start breaking that when a child kind of wants to join the adult world, which is around 10 years old. And then when they become 12, they can take hunter safety. They will have had a familiarity with firearms, and then they can concentrate on some of this, some of the other aspects that hunter safety hits on. So I would say about 10 years old would, in my mind, be the best age to start a child shooting. And those are with shoulder arms. And the shoulder arms for a child have to meet certain criteria. As I said before, they should be simple to operate, simple to see if they're safe, and they should be sized for the child too. Most guns in America are built for average man, which is about 5'8", 5'9", and the kind of arms and all that. That's just the way they do it, you know. And there are very few outside of the AR world. There's very few adjustable stocks. But most guns are built with a fixed stock, which is built for an average person, and that may not fit, especially a younger or smaller statured child. Yeah, I have the same problem with some females too. You know, it's hand an FNFAL to a woman who's 5'4", 5'5", and you know, while they can usually adapt and get to the point where they use it, it's not the ideal dimensions for them. So I would be very, very you have to make some good choices there. And you may have to either buy a few new stocks and put it on for a while, or get a stock that has some sort of adjustability as where you can add pads onto it. They do make youth models, which are nice and can actually be changed in some manufacturers. So those are good things. And management of recoil, most of that is psychological, but the muzzle blast and noise definitely have an effect. And so the smaller calibers are usually better, so that a young person can get used to it and definitely develop some good habits, because you don't want somebody flinching like crazy. A related question to that is, when should someone start handgun training? And I would say that you have to do all these things I talked about previously. And then I think you have to wait and have some years of experience. So you're really talking probably mid to later teens, 16, 17. Yes, start to use the handgun at that point, and they'll understand the mechanics of marksmanship, safety, and all the rest of these things. And short guns, handguns are usually, they can be more of a challenge to keep safe and keep pointed in the appropriate direction and all that, because the muzzle is so short. Sweeping people with a muzzle is completely unacceptable. So, you know, that's a good time to start training someone on a handgun is when they have a good basis of firearms experience, understand how sights work, all this kind of stuff. The other thing too is, the legal possession of a handgun is really turned into a 21-year-old thing. Now, when I was growing up, it was different. I could take handguns to the range. When I was 18, 19, 20 years old, nobody said boo. Nowadays, I think it's a different situation. So, you got to watch that 21-year-old threshold for owning a handgun and where that goes. But definitely, it's a good skill to have, and there's a lot of good handguns on the market. Again, the first handgun for someone, you can't go wrong with a 22 with an exposed hammer, and I would say even your first center fire gun, if it's got an exposed hammer, you can immediately tell if it's cocked. Those are all very, very good things. So, simpler, better, keep it safe. Okay, let's look at another question here. What are the best and worst parts of gun fiction? Again, I'm not an expert on this because I don't see all of the gun fiction that's out there, but I would have to say that what I do see are just kind of trends. I think the very best is the kind of the revival westerns that we've seen over maybe the last 30 years, things like Tombstone and some of all these, too many to list, but it seems that there's been a move towards authenticity in both firearms and holsters and how people wore guns, how people used them. There seems to be a big advancement in just the authenticity of rifles and pistols of the Old West and making sure that what they have is period correct. There's still obvious faux pas here and there, but it's much more makes it much more palatable for me to watch. Westerns that have, model 1892 Winchester showing up in the 1840s or 1850s are ridiculous. And from my perspective, I realize that as general entertainment, they're probably okay to for people who don't pay attention to those details. But I think that Westerns have improved greatly in that respect. The types that I don't like seeing are the usual things that everybody complains about in general movies, guns that have an incredible effect. And if you look at the movie, it's one of my favorites actually, but Bruce Willis in Last Man Standing, he shoots people with a 1911 and they're flying through windows and they get hit by the bullet and they immediately do backflips backwards and everything. An effect that particular weapon really does not generate. Although it's entertaining, it is not realistic. Other things that aren't realistic are magazines that never seem to run dry. Just every bad guy immediately falls dead when shot. They're immediately lethal. They never miss. All those kinds of things that everybody usually complains about. The other part that's always big for me is, unless an actor is drawing the gun, a character is drawing the gun, they never seem to have it on there. So they're walking around in a business suit or a blazer, unencumbered by the fact that they're carrying a gun, because they don't have it in scenes where they're not going to use it, and they only have it in this for the cut where they're gonna draw it and go for it. So therefore, some of the unrealistic guns you see them carrying, you're using in the movies, they would never carry, Desert Eagles and some of this, which are just too large and ponderous. You would just never see that. So those are the things I really don't care for. I also the probably though the biggest thing that really bothers me is the actors who make a living in gun movies, gun-related movies, or playing characters that are gunmen, gunslingers, or use firearms very heavily. And then in their personal life, they advocate gun control for the rest of us. So it's good enough for them to cash in and make money on, but it's bad for the rest of us to to have any sort of protection or to have a firearm. So those kind of things can really turn me off. And unfortunately, that's a lot of Hollywood. And there are some, unfortunately, very talented actors that fall into that category. I would have to say that the movies I find which are the most fun are the ones that show a variety of firearms. The original Tremors, I still think that's a very funny movie in a lot of ways, and I think it's very entertaining, and I enjoyed the firearms in that. Recently, the Highwayman spent a lot of attention to detail on the firearms, and I really like that, and I thought that it was very, very well done. Another show which does an excellent job is AMC, The Sun. The one starring Pierce Brosnan, early Colt automatics, a Lewis gun, 351 Winchester 94 lever guns, all in that 1915, you know, kind of pre-World War I period, World War I for the U.S. anyway, period, I think was really entertaining for me to watch, and very, very good. You know, the revolvers, all those classic guns out there. And after all, this is Old School Guns Podcast, so those classic guns were not only the icons, but they were just a tribute to the manufacturer's art and skill of how could you assemble something like a triple lock revolver, which was hand finished. Essentially, it's that amalgam of Industrial Revolution. We can produce these things, and then craftsmanship, individual craftsmanship of putting that together and creating a real masterpiece. And a lot of the interesting designs. A 351 Winchester, one of my favorite rifles and designs. Tough to shoot because the ammo you have to make yourself. You can occasionally find small batches of it, but a very, very interesting design, especially for that period. It was something that was quite revolutionary. Intermediate cartridge, magazine fed, not an assault rifle, or what we would term as an assault rifle, but a very, very interesting peek into what the future held. And it was actually used in World War I in some quantities. So, you know, the French, Russians, and even the British used a few. And U.S. Army Air Service chasing Pancho Villa had some. By 1917, aircraft armament had progressed to the point where these rifles were no longer needed. So I imagine they served in some other capacity in France and Russia. But very interesting guns. I do like Johnny Depp's movie Public Enemies. I thought that showcased the Thompson and to a lesser degree the BAR exceptionally well. You know, pretty exciting to watch. One of the funny, I shouldn't say funny, one of the interesting aspects of watching those movies is that usually when a Thompson goes off, they usually dub in a much louder track to show the gunfire reports. The shots are much louder than they would be in real life, you know, so it kind of builds that myth of the Thompson as a super weapon, because it sounds, you know, more powerful than an M1 rifle, which it clearly is not. I thought that was excellent. I thought a lot of the war movies are some of the ones made in the 1960s were horribly bad, but, you know, Saving Private Ryan had a few mistakes, but I thought that basically it showed weapons in a kind of a true form. Same thing with Fury. I thought Fury was excellent. Brad Pitt's character having the sweetheart grips on his 1917 revolver and using a captured STG-44. I thought that was an interesting touch, and then you see the Thompsons and a few other things in there that are really a grease gun. I think you see grease guns in there also. You know, a very interesting amalgam of weapons, and you know, very, very entertaining for a gun person to watch. So I think you can really judge the quality of the movie by the attention they pay to the firearms. You know, I can remember watching, there's one scene in the Devil's Brigade with William Holden where they're coming up some canal, and the camera just goes onto the Thompsons, and they don't have rear sights. They're obviously rubber duckies, what we used to call in the military rubber duckies, which were just a rubber resin replica of a firearm that you would use for swim testing and other things like that. So where you needed something that could replicate a gun, but you didn't want to use an actual firearm for it. So but you can tell when they're using rubber duckies. Some of the early Untouchables episodes are the same thing, where they're even just rocking the gun back and forth to simulate recoil. You know, it's pretty comical to watch, but it's entertainment has to have some creative license, and they don't have unlimited budgets, so sometimes you just have to suck that up. But it is, when you know firearms, it is entertaining to watch some of these shows and realizing that it's what they're showing you is completely bogus, absolutely completely bogus. But they're getting more authentic. If The Highwayman and Fury and some of these other types of movies are the harbingers, I think they're paying the attention, because it gives the movie a much more authentic feel, and it's really not that expensive to go after. Not certainly like it would have been in the 1960s, where it was a lot harder to find some of this stuff and would take a lot more effort. Now they can locate it much easier, and I think there's some people who are just dedicated to making it a little bit better product. Well, hey, that's it for this edition of Old School Guns, and we will talk to you next time. This is Old School Guns, out.